The Mixing Music Podcast is proud to say that we have a lot of free resources outside of the actual podcast. Visit mixingmusicpodcast.com/links to find access to our free PDFs and free resources.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
Welcome to the DK Podcast.
There you go. Well, anyway, welcome, John. I haven't seen you in a minute. How you been?
Very good, man. Very good. I'm very blessed. Can't complain. Could sleep some more.
You could sleep some more?
Yeah.
Are your kids, do you have any young kids right now?
Oh, yeah, man. I got so many. I got an 8-year-old, an 11-year-old, and a 12-year-old.
Are they all sleeping well?
I mean, they seem to be sleeping well. Yeah.
So you're just not sleeping well because you're staying up late or whatever.
Yeah. I kind of hit my stride in the evenings. You know, once I put them to bed, then it's, you know, I really hit my kind of golden window for uninterrupted activities.
I've heard this. Have you ever heard that a lot of creatives tend to be night owls and like get that creative juice flowing in the evening? Do you feel like that's the way for you then?
I feel like it is because I don't know. I can't speak for anyone else, you know, but I've heard some of the same sort of things, but I think that, it takes me about 20, 25 minutes to get really rolling in like whatever creative aspect that is. And whether it's creating music, mixing music, producing, whatever it is, mm-hmm. like, or even just, you know, dealing with admin stuff. Like to really get into it and get rolling in about 25 minutes and to have it uninterrupted, no one being like, daddy, do this. And I'm not complaining about that at all. I love it. But I'm more productive when I'm not interrupted.
And how late do you usually go till? Like keep working till?
Sometimes I have breakfast with the family.
Oh, for real? You can go all night.
Yeah, man.
Going all night. That's crazy.
Everyone's got deadlines, right? And unfortunately, they all pick the same day to have the deadline on. So, we roll until the deadline's met or, you know, until I'm collapsing. When I can't hear anymore, when I'm like, I'm done. That's when I'm like, okay, I need to go.
Do you feel like there's like a limit for you? Like if you do like 4 hours or 6 hours, then like you have to take a break or anything like that?
Well, I take breaks all the time. Like I take little micro breaks, right?
Like, but so I mean I'll like have a substantial break. Like, oh, I'm really lost my bias right now.
I don't know. It's gotten better over the years. It used to be like I can go for a solid 4 to 6 hours before I need to take a, you know, 15 half hour break. That's if I'm in like the critical phase, right? Like I can rough stuff out for, you know, 16 plus hours, but like the getting really detailed, that's when I have to step away more.
Yeah, for sure. I feel like, we always talk about hearing fatigue or like ear fatigue, but like you said, like you've gotten better over the years. I also feel like I've gotten better over the years. Like the ability to stay unbiased. I don't know about you. Does it feel that way?
It It does. But I also use references to like make sure I'm anchored back into the reality of the world.
How do you use references? Like specifically, how do you use references?
Like I'll
upload it into the Pro Tools session or?
Yeah. So like I'll use, what's that? Sample Magic AB or whatever that thing is.
Uh-huh.
Oh, not Sample Magic anymore. The new
metric
one.
AB?
Adapter AB. Yeah. So I'll put that in the session and then I load in references. So if I'm mixing a hip hop tune, I've got, you know, my references in there. Or if I'm R&B or Afrobeats or whatever it is, I've got my references in there. And then, you know, I just pause and go, okay, where am I? And I also have the rough mix in there as well because, you know, I have to beat the rough mix every time. So
no, for real.
Otherwise I don't work, you know?
Yeah. Have you ever had like a damn intimidating rough mix where you're like, oh, sheesh, like I got to earn my money on this one.
Yeah, I've had a lot of them. I've had a lot of them, man. You know, some of the best mixers in the world are producers. Right. Mm. Like, but they don't think of themselves as mixers. Some of them don't have the technical ability, but they got the vibe. And so then I'm dealing with something which has all the vibe in the world and they've somehow made it insanely loud. And I've got to make mine feel the same way. But sometimes I can't be as loud because they're like beyond radio, beyond what they're like, you know. -3, right? And I'm like, okay, this is not going to work. So I've got to maintain that energy, that intensity,
but at a significantly
lower volume, right? And those are always intimidating because
oh, for sure.
I know that I get tricked by volume. You know, you turn it up, even a half dB or dB, you're like, I don't know, man, this just sounds better to me, and it's volume, and so I have to try to play around with that myself and make sure that I'm not just tricking myself.
What are some like typical habitual things that techniques that you use or things that you look out for to kind of maximize punchiness while balancing loudness? You a big clipper guy? You like to clip a lot?
Yeah. Are you a big clipper guy? You look like a clipper guy. I've started for the longest time I was using the IK Multimedia Stealth Limiter, which is like you can push it really hard, but mind you, I'm mixing with that on the master right from beginning. Like right when I'm getting my sounds, I've got my limiter on.
I have to ask you about this later, but keep going.
Sure. So for the longest time it was that, and I have a multiband compressor before that. Couple things on the master, kind of for some overall sculpting. But Jason Joshua's God Particle is ridiculous. And it does a lot of the same stuff. And it's just easy. So I put it on and I'm like, yeah, this is really good. Okay, so that's now my main one. And if it has problems with, you know, clipping or limiting or whatever it's doing, then I've got the other guys, you know, disabled right after it. So I can take out his limiter and put the other ones in and for different scenarios.
So what I wanted to ask, we literally did an episode about this on like the actual podcast. Maybe it was an exclusive episode that we have hidden behind paywalls. If you're interested in that, you know, this is not for you, John, but for the audience.
1995.
It's $3.99 at mixandmusicpodcast.com. Anyway, we did an exclusive episode and we took out, what we do is we take out clips from like big interviews from big producers and whatnot or mixers. And then we kind of break it down. And one of them, and I have a lot of friends who mix with a limiter at the beginning. And like you said, a multiband for basic sculpting. The way that I was trained and the people that I learned under as well, like, nothing on the mix bus, and I kind of added afterwards. Why do you think it's beneficial to do that? I was trying to listen to the episode and listen to that thing, and I just couldn't fathom it. I've never thought of audio or that workflow in that way. Can you explain some of that, the reasoning?
Sure. So I did it the same way that you're talking about originally, and I did it for years like that. And then what would happen is I'd get a mix sounding luscious. You know, I'm thinking, right? You know, and I'm young, so I was like, this sounds amazing. But then I'd either send it to mastering or I'd put a limiter on it because they're like, you know, we want you to rough limit it or whatever, just for the client. And it would take all the dynamics out. It would make everything just sound squishy and nasty and stupid. And so I had this inkling of putting a limiter on. If I'm going to be smashing it in the end, what if I mix through it and smash while I'm mixing it, so that in the end, I end up with the dynamics the way that I want. I end up with the frequency spectrum. Because when you limit stuff, it changes the perception of frequencies, right? Particularly high end.
Of course.
And so I was like, well, let me sculpt it into the master limiter at the level that the record is going to end up being. And what I do with it then is at the end, once the client has approved it, I take the limiter off. And then I give a limited version. Like, I print all of the mixes limited, you know, the instrumental, full, acapella, whatever, TV, with my limiting on it. And then I print a version with the limiter bypassed. And I set all the same versions. And I send them to the mastering engineer and say, this is the limiter that I used to get this sound. This is how you get it. And make it sound exactly like the client loved. Make it sound better. Because what I was running into is I would do this process and the mastering engineer would be like, we can't get it to sound the same as you did. So I started including the notes on how it was being done with like the screenshot of the plugin and everything, just to make sure that they knew exactly how to get the sound. I'm backtracking. After I had this inkling of doing this and I started to kind of fiddle around with it, I was at one of these talks. Manny American gave a talk, and I asked him during the interview section. I was like, because he kept talking about, oh yeah, and I'm running it back in and da da da. And I was like, are you mixing into a limiter? And he was like, oh yeah, so many da 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 da. And I was like, no, but are you limiting it? And he was like, well, yeah, I'm mixing into a limiter. And I was like, okay, perfect. This is exactly what I need to be doing.
Interesting. So even Manny does, and Manny's one of my favorites too. So that's tough. See, I've always focused on getting better at adding it at the end, like keeping it transparent as a skill, like mastering it as an independent skill, rather than kind of leveling up my mixing through a limiter and smashing it. So I've been looking at it a different way. So I have two technical questions for you. If you mix into a limiter, one, I assume that you're paying attention to gain staging, so you're not hitting -6 on the gain reduction on accident, you know, by the time you're done with it.
Right.
So you're probably looking at the gain reduction or the output meter or something pretty closely the entire time. Is that correct?
The entire time. I have three screens. And on the screen that is up, like the TV one, which in most studios would be like the TV, I have my meter, which I use the Process Audio Decibel. That's my favorite so far. And I have my limiter open and my multiband compressor open so that I can see what they're doing at all times. So I'm not like, accidentally.
Are you pretty flexible with it? Like, do you sometimes push? Like, what's the furthest you push your limiter as far as gain reduction goes? Or like, what do you usually hit?
The answer is yes, I'm flexible with it. The reality is like, it just depends on what the vibe needs, you know, like, there are some tunes that I've mixed where it needs to sound like it's a car crashing into a wall, you know, high speed. And then there's other songs that just it would totally sound inappropriate. It sounds ridiculous. People are going to be like, this guy doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. And they're probably right. But most of the time I'm trying not to do more than 5-6 dB. However, there are times where I've smashed stuff like 9 to 12 dB. And even I'm going, oh God, that's a lot.
But in a single limiter.
Yeah. Yeah. But really? The IK, the stealth limiter, I don't know what the voodoo is behind it. I think it might have like multiple limiters built in or something. It's very transparent. So, and because I'm also mixing into it, I'm hearing what it's doing as it's going. But I mean, like those are for like really, so you ask the most, right? So we're talking extreme, but kind of my rule of thumb is that if it sounds good, it is good, right? And
oh yeah.
So like in those situations, those particular mixes called for, it was hell when I was like, okay, but now I've got to export stems and I want them to sound exactly the same. And that was one of the downfalls of the IK is you couldn't do sidechain. Where, I would route all the audio that way I could solo something and have the limiter triggered by everything, even though I'm only listening to the piano, for example.
Oh, so that was actually going to be my second question, was about soloing. But piggyback thought on that. I mean, for anybody listening right now, that if they feel like they might get judgmental towards you for hitting like those crazy numbers, the point is that you're monitoring, even if it's crazy high gain reduction numbers, you're monitoring from the beginning. So even if it is hitting those numbers, you're paying attention to whether or not it's sounding good or not. And you're continuing to like, oh, it's getting too crunchy, it's getting too hot, or not, or you like the sound of it. Whereas as far as like, the people that do the opposite, like even if they hit really low numbers, but they're not paying attention to it, they're just doing it habitually. I think that is not as thought through as what you're doing.
But I'm also paying attention to what my overall level is, right? Like, mm-hmm. I don't want to smash something and get it to -3 when I know that Spotify is going to turn it down significantly, mm-hmm. right? So I'm paying attention to all of that stuff. And if I find myself in a situation where the gain reduction is ridiculous and then I put the vocal in and the vocal just sounds like it's getting pumped constantly and that's not the vibe, then I look at, okay, well, how can I take this off of the master and I'll put that on, say it's only the drums I really need to be smashed, or say I want the music just to be smashed, but the vocal to ride on top, right? Then I'll take that limiter and I'll move it to an all instrument bus that I have all my instruments going through, and then I'll crush that. And then let the vocal ride on top. I mean, like, so it's really just kind of paying attention to what I want it to sound like and how can I achieve it. And keeping in mind that loud mixes, right? Like, because there is an importance to making sure that your mix can stand up next to whatever it's going to play against. That all happens in the mix phase, right? That's not a mastering issue. That's a mix issue.
Oh yeah, of course.
If you mix without having that in mind, it won't be loud. Even it'll get smashed and it'll sound crushed, but it won't be loud. So.
Oh, for sure. I feel like the way that I've overcome that is my process has as more and more utilized saturation, clipping, limiting. On buses and on individual tracks to preserve headroom. So by the time I'm at the end, if it's a typical pop or hip hop song, I'm hitting like -7 overall, or like I'm in the chorus -7, -6 volume, while pushing like barely maybe two dBs on the gain reduction because I'm squishing it so much in the mix. So that's kind of how I've compensated. So I'm not saying that like one is better than the other, but I'm saying that it's interesting that we can totally develop two trains of thought here. And when we're talking about this, I was just like, I have no idea what's going on. And dude, that actually makes a lot more sense.
But I mean, those are all tools, right? Like there's no, the right way in one song is the complete wrong way in another. Right. So like having a really firm grasp of your tools and the techniques is you just shift. Right. Like I'm not going to approach a ballad the same way. And I love,
oh, for sure.
I love using saturation as kind of a versus EQ or compression. Right. Like essentially, you know, EQing with saturation. What are the saturators you're digging right now?
Ooh, I use a lot of random ones, man. One of my favorites is the Zener saturation built into the Silica on Kush Audio. Sorry, that's like the Kush Audio. Kush Audio makes amazing, like all of their plugins have some form of saturation and they sound amazing. The Mixland Tilt, like the saturation one's good. Decapitator is always a classic that I use from time to time. Spectre, oh, I use Spectre every mix. Have you heard of Spectre? Is it Wave Labs? So it looks like an EQ. You should look it up. It looks like an EQ, and you can filter, boost, and saturate specific frequencies. So it's like it's almost like a boost only EQ, but it boosts via saturation. So it's like really cool.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I use a bunch, man. I'm the Massey Golden Clip Soft Clipper is one of my favorites. Although that's clipping, that's not saturation. But yeah, I use a ton. I also use like a lot of like analog emulated things, like Magic Death Eye is a compressor, but I love the way it saturates. Like it kind of adds this like low mid warmth. It's like tubey thing going on, and the Plugin Alliance Purple 1176. MC77 or whatever it's called, kind of got this like mid-aggressive thing going on with the saturation. So I like also saturate through non-saturation plugins, if that makes sense.
Sure. No, of course. Yeah, because they're all emulating different analog hardware that's, you know, doing its thing.
Yeah.
Have you tried the oven?
I have been messing a little bit with it. Have you played with it a lot?
Oh man, I'm really digging it. And Maor is a friend, and yeah, I felt Maor, bad because I hadn't tried it out and for a while, and he kept being like, "Oh, you want to try it out?" And I was like, "Yeah, man, I totally do." We just never hooked up, and then it came out as a plugin, and I was still like a month, 2 months behind, and I pulled it up, and I was like, "Oh my god, this is crazy!" So I'm actually using it quite a bit. I'm really digging it on drums. I'm really digging it on vocals. Yeah, I like the sculptability of it. That you mentioned a saturator that's kind of like an EQ. That's kind of what that one is doing. So,
oh, for sure. So I've actually used the real hardware unit at Bob's place, at Bob Horn's place.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And dude, it's so cool. I haven't gotten the chance to use it, but, or no, I've used it on like 3 or 4 mixes, but I haven't used it extensively enough to kind of form a proper opinion.
Right.
Like, I feel like it takes me, like, I want to use it on multiple mixes over a course of couple months on different sort of things before I form a proper opinion. But I mean, so far I've liked it enough where I keep giving it a try every once in a while.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The Black Box, too. The Black Box was great.
The HG2, that one?
Yeah.
Yeah. That was before the oven. That was the Black Box was my main one. And then now the oven is slowly starting to replace that.
Really?
But yeah, but I you know, I use Decapitator all the time, and I use the Fab Filter Saturn. There's a lot of different ones where you push and they give some interesting sounds. But yeah, the oven is kind of starting to replace the HG2 for me.
Do you kind of like web in and out of different habits? Because I mean, everybody has habits, including us chaotic engineers, right? Like you kind of do like the same sort of chain or the same few plugins, but you use them differently. I mean, obviously we adjust them, right? But I mean, like, do you find yourself mixing really dirty for a few months and then mixing really clean other months? Just like, I don't know, just have habits. Do you kind of go in and out of different zones?
I think so, yeah. And I think it has a lot to do with what I'm mixing, right? Like, so if I'm mixing a lot of really aggressive stuff and then someone throws me a very non-aggressive song, I have to try to wean myself away from making it sound aggressive. Like, if I'm really in that vein. I would say that, I don't know, as I learn like new techniques or get new tools or new inspiration from hearing something, you know, maybe I'll change some stuff around. Yeah, I guess that it's always morphing, right? Like I'm always just trying to become better making the mixes sound as good as I want them to in my head. I'm never there, but I'm like, it's that thing that I'm constantly reaching for.
Do you feel like you're morphing now just as frequently as you morphed 10 years ago?
I think it's different. So the short answer is yes, I think I am. Mm-hmm. But back then it was like learning basics, right? But like now I'm doing that same amount of morphing, but it's in refining, you know, like, I think that every time I think I'm doing pretty decent, I look back like 5 years later and I'm like, man, sometimes I look back a couple months later and I'm like, man, I sucked. So, yeah, there's not a mix that I've done that I haven't looked back and gone, man, I wish I could adjust that one thing, because I am continually trying to become better at what I do and what the way that I hear and like, you know, even, you know, upgrading a something in my mix room or, you know, my monitors or something, and I'm hearing some things differently and I'm like, ah, crap. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you feel like there is going to ever be a point where you're like, yeah, I'm the best? Like, do you think that's ever going to come for you? So how do you deal?
Where I think I'm the best? No, never.
Or rather, you know, because you were saying, like, you listen to old mixes and you're like, oh, I could have changed it. But I mean, do you think you'll ever get to the point where, like, that's the best that I could have done for this song? Like, I'm really proud of this work. Nothing I would have changed. Do you think that'll ever happen for you?
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
You know, mixes are a lot like, you know, bands create songs, right? And those songs are snapshots of those bands at that time. And they go on, they develop, and they create new songs. And I think it's the same thing with mixes for me. That's a snapshot of at that time that is the best that I was able to do at that time. And I can still listen to it and really, I listen to some of my older mixes and I'm like, yeah, I really like this. But this is what I would do differently. So I don't know. It's like a snapshot. It's a great stepping
stone.
So
it's not necessarily always, I wish I would have improved on it. Sometimes it's, I would have done something different if I were to mix it now.
Correct.
So it's more, okay.
Always that, yeah.
There's a little, last time you were here, I'm going to share something personal. Like, you came to my personal home and you hung out with me. You're in Ohio, correct? At the moment. And you came out, was it for like a Grammys party or something like that? Why did you come out to L.A.?
Well, I lived in L.A.
Was it? This was before you moved.
Yeah. This was before I moved. Yeah, okay, I've only been in Ohio for like the last, 9 months or 10 months? 9 months?
Is the house done? Because I know you were building it out or something like that.
It is. The house is done. The studio is still being constructed. So I'm in a room in the house, which I've brought all my stuff into and all my acoustic treatment, and it'll be this way until we move into the other space.
Oh, cool, man. Yeah, we were talking about people leaving LA. I mean, LA keeps shrinking in population every year for the last couple of years, and maybe I want to jump into the idea of, when did you move to LA and what for, and what do you think about leaving?
I moved to LA, this is probably about 2006. 2005, 2006. And then what brought me to LA was I'd been in New York for 10 years and it had kind of run its course. And I was sort of, it had lost its magic for me at that point in my life. And I met my, who became my fiance, and she didn't like the cold. And I was like, cool, let's go somewhere else.
And I mean, you're messed up if you like the cold or something. That.
Yeah. So we ended up, I'll cut out the whole story of the circuitous route that we got there, but we ended up in LA. And
with big dreams, or just like, was there family here, or is it like trying to get into the industry, like with big hopes and dreams?
Well, I mean, I was in the industry in New York, right? Like I was already
LA industry, LA.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it was, I'm going to LA. We're going to do the same thing I was doing in New York, but with beaches and palm trees.
Do you feel like, I mean, you were already working professionally out of New York. When you moved to LA, was there a certain level of restarting that you had to do?
Yeah, absolutely.
Even when as an established engineer out in New York.
Yeah, like I had been working professionally in New York for 10 years. At that point, I was mixing a lot of indie projects, some for labels, and I was a chief engineer at a really small studio. I was assistant engineer in a couple other studios. Like I was hustling, right?
Oh, yeah.
And when I moved out to LA, I didn't have the connections out in LA. And so I was like, okay, what do I know inside and out? Because my wife is from Kenya. And so work visa, we had to wait for that. And so she couldn't work. And I was like, okay, I need to earn money. What am I going to do? How do I get to meet people? And I was like, oh, there are these music places, the music stores. So I got a gig at Westlake Pro, which at that time was at Westlake Studios. And I was
cool.
Oh,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't have to like deal with customers walking in and want to play guitars, because it was like just offices. You go out and you meet studio people and you're in a studio. And so I used that to just meet tons of people. And, you know, I didn't say,
and
hey,
spend all the money you earned on the discounted gear.
That's absolutely the truth.
You got to afford. It takes a lot to afford working at a gear retail store.
So I did that. I did it really well. I introduced myself every time. I'm, you know, John Rice, I'm an engineer, right? Like, I'm not your salesperson. I'm an engineer. And so people would buy stuff and, you know, I'd tell them what they need for their particular situation. They'd have me come look at their studio, figure stuff out. Then they'd have me install it. And then they'd hire me to work on projects. And it was just like, it built. I was done after 6 months. As soon as I had enough clients, I quit.
And I assume you were making decent money there too. So.
It was surviving money, right?
Okay, but like the thing is,
it was not. I was mixing like I was like doing the whole mixing thing after hours, right? So I'd do that, and then I'd go back to our tiny little apartment, and I'd mix.
I mean, that's a good thing. If you were making too much money at Westlake, it would have been super difficult to quit. You would have been probably rationalizing, "Oh, how can I do both still?" The golden handcuffs, you know.
It's not my passion, right? It wasn't my. There have been numerous times where I've turned away from the easy money thing that wasn't in line with what I wanted to do, because I knew it would lock me up. And I think that having that kind of single-minded, stubborn focus on what it is I want to do has kind of saved me a lot of situations. So yeah, as soon as I had a chance from there, and luckily getting married is all about finding the right partner. And we were around month four, month five working there, and I'm suddenly having enough clients, and she's like, you need to quit. And I was like, yeah, but this is supporting us. She's like, the work visa is about to come through. You need to quit. This is not what you want to do. This is not feeding your soul. So,
she was pushing you. That's good. That's a wife, good partner there.
Yeah. So anyway, that was it. We cut ties with them, and they're great. Like, we're still friends to this day with the people that worked there. And it was an amazing opportunity. And it helped me in a number of ways, getting to know people, getting gear at discounts. I got to see like all the studios because I was going in there as a consultant or whatever. So
this goes back to the idea of, like, I talk about this all the time. It feels like a sense of, you said, stubbornness, but I almost say like selfishness, where it's like, I am way too creative to allow myself to do things for money, or something that like do something that I don't want to do. Like, I just, maybe it's the ADHD, maybe it's like cultural values. I think it's honestly just like, I like to say that it's my creativity. Like, I'm way too creative to do something boring for something as dull as money. Like, I always chase after personal fulfillment, which has been bad sometimes. But at the same time, like, it's naturally created these barriers where I have no clients that I hate. And I have no labels that are, like, running over me. You know, and I've created a difficult, it wasn't easy, but I'm sure that you feel the same way. Like, you've created success in a way that eventually became comfortable for you. Do you feel like that's the case?
Yeah, I think with mine, it's more the way I've developed things is just surrounding myself with good people. Like, and then when I find good people, like, we like form a chain link, right? Like, it's okay, we're gonna continue to work together. And you know, there have been gigs that I've done because it's like, okay, I don't hate this, but I'm not in love with it, but you need help. And at that point I turn, okay, how can I be of service? Right. Mm. Because some things aren't feeding me in terms of creatively. They will feed my family. And I can be of service to them, right. Yeah. To whoever that person is. And those gigs happen, not regularly, but they do definitely happen where it's like, okay, I'm going to be of service to this person.
Yeah, for sure. So you said, good people, right? And I always talk about, I'm very careful to make sure that I promote that success comes through being a good person, which I think is really true. Right. But I also want to ask you, in the eyes of John Rezin, what are some key, we talk about red flags, but what are some like green flags of like someone that's a genuinely good person that you might want to be friends with?
I think people, okay. So for example, when I met you,
uh-oh.
You know, like there, yeah, no. I mean, like lots of green flags, right? Like you are well-spoken, you're thoughtful. You care about doing the right thing. You're striving for excellence. You're a family man who cares about his family. They're not a burden to you. Like you showed me the books that, you know, you and your wife are writing about your kids. They're crazy. They're amazing. Writing songs about, I mean, like people, when I meet people who seem to have their compass in life aimed in the right direction, or at least aimed in the same direction as I'm striving to aim, right? Then it's like, okay, those are people that I would like to, you know, keep on the inside circle, right? Like, I don't know. I think it's always, and sometimes it's almost like an energy, right? Like you meet somebody and you're like, you feel like you've known them forever. And then as long as like they're not, you know, far from, you know, they seem nice, but they turn out to be a serial killer. Okay, then you got to put them on the outside circle, right?
No, it's interesting that you said specifically well-spoken because I feel like I relate to that a lot. Anytime that someone is particularly like articulate or like able to process thoughts and able to kind of listen to ideas at face value without kind of digging deep into what they meant by it or trying to figure out what the manipulation is. Or like you also said like a compass, right? I feel like sometimes I'm wondering, very few people have like a negative downward compass where they're like trying to provoke and be evil. I feel like most everyday evil comes from people without a compass in general. Like people that don't have an upward direction or a direction at all.
Mm.
And do you feel that way? Like, do you feel like people need to have some kind of direction or else it could be bad?
I think that it helps for sure because you need something that you are striving towards or working towards or building towards. I mean, just living in this world and dealing with the stuff that we deal with every day, you can kind of, you know, it's almost like you're a bird and you like fall into the dust and your wings are covered in mud. You want to fly, but like you're stuck, you know, and there are people who get themselves stuck and yeah. And don't care enough to unsully their wings, you know?
So how do you keep your compass facing towards the direction? Well, maybe how did you or continuously define where you want to go? And then on top of that, how do you continue to focus that direction?
That's a good question. Nothing is set it and forget. It's constantly readjusting. There was this analogy I heard that planes, like if you're flying from LA to Hawaii, 99% of the time, the plane is going the wrong direction. But they're constantly readjusting, these little micro readjustments, and then you finally land where you're going, right? And I like that idea because humans kind of suck at being perfect, right?
Hold on. Out of context quote. Humans kind of suck.
Well, I mean, like, right? We're not perfect. No one's perfect, right? And so we're always making mistakes, sometimes big, sometimes small.
Hold on. Our wives. Other than our wives.
Other than our wives. Who are... No. The... So we're always making mistakes, right? And always readjusting. How do I keep focused? I think that the my wife and I consult a lot. Like we sit down and chat and try to figure out what we're trying to achieve and how close we are to achieving that, and not if we need to change things, you know, how we're educating our children or hey, I'm thinking about this in my work. What do you think? And we talk about it. We talk about work emails that I'm sending, right? Like if I've got to deal with a difficult client or, you know, like we consult a lot. I think consultation with people who have your best interest in mind and also have, you know, capacity to be of great assistance is important. I think the other thing that really keeps my compass is my faith. The Baha'i writings, I'm a Baha'i, that's my religion. A big part of the Baha'i writings talks about work done in the spirit of service is worship. And so I'm always trying to keep in mind, like, I'm not a doctor, right? Like, I'm not, you know, let me save their life or, you know, I'm making music, right? But music can affect people in really significant ways, transformative ways, right? And so I'm always looking at, even though I'm not a doctor, even though I'm not, you know, fireman, even though I'm not whatever, my work has value. How can I be of service with what I'm doing to whoever I'm doing it for? I think that is a big part of it. And then also, you know, trying to be a good father really keeps me focused because my children reflect both their mother and me, right? So if they're doing something that is unbecoming, invariably it's something that we are doing or not doing. And we're like, oh yeah, that's bad. We need to change that about ourselves.
Yeah.
Right. So,
oh yeah.
I think those are overarching things. But I think they apply to kind of how my career and everything else has gone. And I guess I combine them because so this is a compass issue. So early on when I was starting, I said, I want a wife and children. I want a family, right? And I could do the whole grind and be an engineer and not have those things and probably be successful, but that's not success for me, right? And so having this full package, even though it meant in many cases not going as at breakneck speed, right? As a slower burn, but I have my goal, right? Like I have everything. And so even though I may not be in my career as, I don't know how you would phrase successful, but I am successful because I'm working on great music. I'm working on stuff I really enjoy, you know, people are appreciating my work and I have an amazing family and I get to work from home. So, you know, that's amazing.
Yeah. How do we define success? You know, this is a serious topic I talk about. You're kind of making me think one thing that's sticking out right now is sometimes I feel like I define success based on, am I the type of person people want to be around? And two, am I the type of person that is able to take on responsibility and uphold, you know, stand on top of my responsibilities, take control of my responsibilities.
It's what so do you mean by that second one?
Like, I feel like maybe this is me as a man, and maybe this is my wiring from my parents or my, I don't know, but I feel like the more responsibilities that I have and the more responsibilities that I can control, as in take care of, small things from paying rent and taxes to being a good father, being there for my kid during his basketball games, to being emailing, replying and responding often to my emails, to my clients, being active at my church or whatever, hanging, making the time to hang out with friends. As long as I have more responsibilities and I'm in control of them, I feel like I'm successful. And I feel like the times that I have personally felt more depressed and less successful wasn't because I didn't have things that were, you know, fruits. I wasn't reaping any fruits. It was because I personally knew that I wasn't being responsible in the way that I could be. Like, if that makes sense.
I think so. The challenge, though, I, and this is the conversation part, right? So, the challenge is that based on that definition, I definitely am not successful. What I mean by that is I agree with you 100%. But there's a certain point at which work is so much and the responsibilities mount up so much and there are so many things that the replies get slower. Making sure you follow up with it, you know, and like things start to fall off and you're like, and this is that sort of weird kind of point in life that I'm in, right? Everything's phases, right? So that phase of like things have to slip through the cracks because, for example, my kids are avid swimmers, right? So they're always in swim meets and stuff. I have to be at the swim meet, right? And
of course, yeah.
So yes, maybe I didn't get back to you right when you needed me to. Sorry. I have to make a choice, right? And so it's an interesting thing because right now I feel like the responsibilities that I have are significantly more time than I have to achieve them. But like somehow I managed to get the things done. But it's like a mad race. But I definitely don't feel like, you know, oh, it's easy breezy. It's more like, oh God, it's all on fire. How do I
drown less?
Yeah. Which one can I put out first? But you know, that's why I have some, you know, assistants and stuff who I send stuff to, and I'm finding ways to outsource, and that's very helpful.
But I also feel like it's really responsible to vocalize or at least in mentally prioritize that, hey, my children are more important to me right now than finishing this one project. I feel like in general, that may not be taking care of all your responsibilities, but I think that's incredibly responsible. What I think would be irresponsible is like you just didn't write down that you had this thing going on and you forgot about it.
Right.
And you went to your kids' meet without realizing you missed something. That would be irresponsible.
I'm all about the lists. I've got lists on lists on lists. But you know, something that I think has been really helpful with our children is we talk to them a lot. And obviously they're an age now where like they can comprehend these things. But we talk about, you know, hey, for these next month and a half, I'm going to be in the studio constantly and we're going to have meals together and I'm going to be really like whatever, but it's an important project that will serve our family well and is really important for, you know, my career and whatever. And we consult about it. Right. And then they're amazing. Don't worry, daddy, we got you. No problem. And of course my wife is amazing and she's like, don't worry. And that's the thing is like, it's always a balancing act, right? Like, I feel it mostly when she gets sick. If my wife gets sick, then I'm taking over everything, right? And she's doing it the other way. So like sometimes I'm stronger, sometimes she's stronger.
Dude, it's kind of messed up every time I get sick, my wife gets like really excited that I'm like in a really vulnerable state. And she's like, yeah, now I can help you.
That's amazing.
She gets way too excited when I'm just like super vulnerable and throwing up. She's like, hey, you want me to make you food? You want me to take care of you? She's like way too excited to take care of me. It's like concerning a little
bit. That's awesome. You need to let her take care of you a little bit more then.
Yeah, I think that's what it is.
Just randomly request soup from her. And she'll enjoy that. That's amazing.
It's so funny. We talk about all the time. I feel like just like you and your wife, you've spoken a lot about communicating. I think that's important. And not just in marriage, but in business. So I have a lot of experience starting businesses and also failing a bunch of businesses. But always, like 9 out of 10, 10 out of 10 times, it's problems occur because of miscommunication, which typically interprets into some sort of false or non-communicated expectation. Expectations then fail. So for example, like I know like a lot of young kids these days, or I don't know what it is. People don't realize how difficult it is to like be married to someone and like not be able to just break up with them, you know? And I sometimes are like marriage is really hard, but like, I don't know. I think marriage can be really hard, but at the same time, I feel like I've set my expectations properly and continue to communicate in a way where at the end of it, there's been hard moments, but in general, I feel like it's been easy specifically due to my expectations.
Mm. I think it's hard not being married, quite frankly. Like like that whole single life thing is I'm not into it, man. And like
the pressure,
I think. Now, mind you, if you're married in a bad situation, I think that's probably worse because then you feel kind of stuck. But
of course,
I don't know. Expectations are a challenge. Like I tend to over communicate, and I don't know if it's really over. I'm gonna say over.
Is that possible though?
Yeah. So this is the thing. I don't think it really is. Some people are like, why do you say all these things that are like really obvious? Because I'll do it even in work. I'll be like, hey, I'm sending you that thing, and please remember da 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 da. Right? Mm. And they're like, dude, I know that. And I'm like, I'd rather say it than have an expectation that you're going to remember that one rando thing that I, you know, had told you before and you not deliver, right? Like, so I'd rather over communicate and be like, okay, we're doing this and okay, are we all on the same page type of thing? So I don't know. And I'm sure it's annoying to some people, but it's worked for me.
I've discovered through my therapy that I've recently restarted again. I have a lot of trauma apparently, or like healing that I need to do specifically around people being dishonest. And I am like really hyper honest to the point where I am perceived as an asshole to a lot of people. Like, and this is why I do so well as like a CEO type kind of thing, because I'm not mean. I'm just really honest. And if you're fucking up, I'm going to tell you without being ashamed. Like, hey, this is tough to say, but you're fucking up right now. Like I won't sugarcoat things. And so, and that's because of, I'm discovering now, it may be because of some potential traumas and different people that I've met in my life that have kind of helped me to develop this sort of like assertiveness. And it's not like, anyway, it makes me think about that. I talk way too much. Like the first episode that we recorded of this Mixing It Up with Daddy D, like half the episode was me talking about like really embarrassing or like should be embarrassing poop stories.
Oh my God.
I just don't give a shit. Like it's just, I wish I was, I should be more embarrassed.
You should cut all those together and do like a super cut. Super poop cut.
Super poop cuts. Dude, yeah. I have, someday I'll share with you offline because I've already shared it, but I have a romantic poop story. Don't even get me started. I'll tell you
some other time. All right. Yeah. Offline, please. No visuals are needed though. Okay.
Do you feel like you're like, even with your wife, do you feel like that you talk your... Well, I mean, I feel like over-communicating is a skill. Do you feel like you're able to successfully communicate how you feel to your wife or to other people often?
With my wife, yes. We spend a lot of time consulting together and like sharing and, you know, talking about vulnerabilities and, you know, I'm going through this and it's just random times. Like if I, you know, it'll happen. Like I'll have a rough thing with a client and I'll be like, you know, I'll just tell her, hey babe, by the way, I'm feeling down right now because this, that, that. And then, you know, she's like, I got you. Okay, I understand. Thank you for sharing it with me. You know, like, and we talk about those things, right? Because sometimes it's, you know, it's not that anything can be done or maybe the thing is already done or whatever it is, but it's just important for us as partners to be able to know, okay, he's on low fuel right now. Yeah. So let me step up and vice versa. She tells me the same things. She'll be like, hey, you got a second? Sure. Yeah. What? Oh, I just had this conversation. Okay, cool. Yeah. Sorry that happened, babe. I got you. I'll put the kids to bed tonight and da 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 da, whatever, you know, like, with other people, I try to communicate what is necessary for the relationship.
Do you feel like you're particularly good at communicating?
Man, I have no idea.
Do you feel like when you express yourself, do you feel like I successfully expressed myself, or do you feel like you have a hard time articulating? Well, here's what the thing:
how do you judge that? How do you judge whether you have successfully expressed yourself? Because it really is all about. There's two facets, right? There is expressing yourself needing somebody else to understand. And if they've understood, then you've successfully communicated, right? That's one level of communication. And I never know if I've successfully communicated until that person essentially echoes back to me what I was saying and I can tell that they understood it, right?
Yeah.
But then there's also the communication where I need to say something, get it off my chest, and I don't care how you receive it. I just need to say it. That's a whole nother thing. And that one I think is easier to go, yeah, I express myself well for myself. But I think that the importance is the receiver, receive the message.
That's true.
And that's why, like, modifying the way that messages are delivered for particular people. So like either adjusting the time when I deliver the message or how I deliver it. You know, I've got friends everyone has traumas, right? Like everyone has been traumatized. So because I'm striving to communicate well and striving to be a good friend, I'm also trying to consider people's traumas, right? So like if I've got to share something that's going to step right in the middle of that trauma, I try to find a way to share that with that person that goes around that trauma. And so that we can have that dialogue and conversation without triggering them. But that's not the same way that I do it for somebody else.
Oh yeah, for sure. I want to turn the car a little bit here, the conversation a little bit. It's fascinating to me. It's fascinating to me that you said you wanted to be a father when you were, it sounded like you described it as when you were fairly young and you kind of knew what you wanted to do. It sounded like you got married during the relatively earlier years of your career. But you are creative enough and free thinking enough and risk averse enough to decide to pursue music as a career, which is like the opposite of everything else that I just described, which is slightly crazy. John, do you feel like you were crazy at one point, or do you feel like you figured out a way to be creative logically, or do you feel like you kind of became more formatted over the years?
I think that I have a kind of a single-minded focus that kind of, for most people, seems unrealistic and verges on significant stubbornness, and in that I know where I want to go and I will find a way to achieve it. There was this story I heard. I don't know if it's true or what the deal was, but I'm sorry, I'm going to butcher it. The gist of it was like the Romans were going to fight war against the Greeks or something. The ships all went over. They landed on the enemy's shores. And then the captain, everyone got off the boats and he said, light the ships on fire. And the soldiers are like, this is how we're getting out of here. He says, the only way we're getting out of here is on their ships.
Burn the boats. That's Cortez story. Yeah.
Okay. Great. Great. So like that idea really resonated with me. Like, backup plans are for those who believe they're going to fail. And that sounds really stupid when you have like responsibilities and, you know, particularly when you're talking to people who have taken very traditional employment options. But I don't know. It's what works for me. And it fuels me when people are like, oh, well, what do you do for fun? I'm like, I do music for fun. But yeah. But like, that's what you do for work. Yeah, exactly. You know, like, so for me, that's what works. And luckily I have a wife who is like, no, this is where you get your juice. This is what you need to be doing. And so she's really insanely supportive.
By the way, I want to rewind a little bit. And I said, you seem risk averse, which means that you're less inclined to take risks. I meant you are risk tolerant. Like, you're very tolerant of risks. You're willing to take risks. And I think that this is like a specific thing.
I think I heard the opposite of that. Because I was good. Like, yeah, you're taking risks. Yes.
Yeah. That's risks. What I meant. So I'm glad you took it the same way, but I just realized that I said the wrong thing. But yeah, you read right into it.
Well, edit that in the
there
post.
You go. And then, but I think it's really interesting. I resonate a lot with you. Like, I'm also like hyper focused. Like, there is no plan B. I've never even considered, like, when my family, when my parents, when friends told me that pursuing music is dumb, at no point did it ever faze me.
Right.
But at the same time, I've always been like extremely free spirited. And I kind of relate that to like my chaotic nature. As when I was a kid, I was really crazy in like a good way. Like, I always like just didn't care, had fun, really blissful, which I feel like kind of like turned into some sort of risk tolerant, hyper focused. I know what I want and I pursue it. Do you feel like, I mean, like, what was John Resnick like in high school? Like, were you really stoic back then and intellectual back then as well? And, you know, like, or do you feel like you loved music, right? I assume. Like, how did that kind of develop?
Well, I actually, in high school, I was figuring out what I wanted to do with my life. And I was actually like contemplating whether to go into medicine or music. Those are the two that I had a real passion for.
Really?
Yeah. And
like, what about medicine? Was it the blood that you just like, you're excited?
No. I think I just like the service aspect of it, right? Like, being able to make a concrete difference in people's lives. And plus I believe there's a lot without getting too much into detail, I guess I think that there's a lot of room for growth in medicine in terms of like, integrating Eastern and Western philosophies and, you know, all this stuff. Right.
So, amen.
I will say less, but music is what I ended up going with. And then, in high school, I there was a performing arts high school, and I auditioned to get in. And, you know, so, 3/4 of my day was spent studying jazz. And they had a little studio there, and that's where I discovered the studio. And yeah. So
may I? I'm trying to pull something out of you specifically for a lot of the Mix and Music podcasts. The demographic that we're trying to reach for is people that are trying to transition into full time, like college or late high school, maybe even like post college, trying to transition into doing music full time. For you, what do you think was the mental shift that happened to either decide to go full time or happen to go full time?
You mean professionally, like start to like get paid and do what I do?
Yeah. As in, I'm done working at the grocery store. Like, did you ever have a part-time job that you hated, or was it just like you went straight into music? Or
so I had part-time jobs, but the once again, the part-time jobs were not like, oh, this is something that is distracting. This is like, I'm using this as a stepping stone. So I'm doing my part-time job while I'm working for free with other people. You know, I'm like, when I would build so I focused on working on as many projects as I could. right? Whether I was getting them off of Craigslist at the time, like people are looking for some of our friends of mine who had bands, or I'm going and approaching people, or I'm reaching out to artists and I'm producing stuff for them. I was doing as much as I possibly could to build as much of a resume as I possibly could, because every project that you do can leverage you into the next project. And no one ever says, oh, well, how much did you get paid for doing that project?
Yeah.
Right? When they're about to hire you and you're like, oh, this is my rate, they're not like, yeah, but what did you get paid for the other one? Mm. Well, I did that for free. No one cares. They just want to know it's awesome.
Yeah.
Right? And if it's awesome, then you can leverage it. So like I ended up working full-time in music in New York while I was going to school there. So I was in college and I was using my student loans to basically subsidize me living in New York City and working in studios. So I'd go to school during the day and I work in studios all night. And then we had access to the studios at school 24 hours a day, like with a key card, whatever. And so then I was bringing in my own clients into the studio at school. I had like, label clients going to this school studio to work.
And, that's the biggest flex ever.
And the teacher having to, you know, like the professor, the main professor, Paul Cozell is his name. And he would come in at like, 8 a.m. And I'm like in the middle of a session. He's like, John, you got to wrap up because I got a class in here in 30 minutes. And I'm like, okay, cool. You know, so... Anyway, I honestly, the biggest thing for me, the biggest shift was just continually trying to do as much as I possibly can and never deciding that there's only one way to do things. Some of my best gigs I've ever gotten have been through like Craigslist. I worked with Toby Gad, who's a songwriter producer, like John Legend, All of Me, and If I Were a Boy, and with Beyonce, and he's a smash songwriter. I got a chance to work with him, and it was through a random Craigslist ad that he posted looking for a mixing engineer, but it didn't have his name on it. But I was like, okay, yeah, let me just hit this guy up and see. That ended up being years of work and working with some amazing people. Wow. And really developing my skills. Cause every gig that I get, I'm looking at how is this helping me develop my craft?
Amazing. That's a great way for young listeners that don't quite have a portfolio, especially like have a backlog of work that you can show off. Like thinking about, is this going to develop my craft? Like, I feel like, will this make me money is a good question, but a bad first question. And I think, like, will this develop my craft is a great first question. I wanted to ask you, do you feel like there was any specific, like, was there any specific turning point in your younger years where there was a moment of epiphany where the boats burned in this moment and you realized no more medicine, nothing else, just music?
Oh, no. When I applied for that high school thing, that was, it was already done. It was a decision. It was like, this is what I'm doing.
Wow.
So I knew that was in my junior year. I guess it was junior and senior years that music program was. Like, when I made the decision to go for that, that was it.
What advice do you have for people that are struggling to find or to decide what they really want?
You mean in terms of like what aspect of the music industry or what aspect of their career? Like what?
So it sounds like in this moment, yeah, let me redefine. It sounds like in this moment, in that moment when you went into the high school program, that was a decision that you're going to do music no matter what. And you were full on 100% energy and focus. I feel like there's been a lot of people on the Discord servers, listeners of the podcast, that love music, but are kind of missing that last step into totally burning the boats and committing. So my question is, it sounds like the ability to commit and make the decision is innate in you. It's just part of you. That seems like it was easy to come for you. For anybody that has a hard time committing to what they want to do in the future or committing to an idea or something, to a direction for their compass, what sort of advice do you think you may have for them?
I think the two things that come to mind as you're saying that is sometimes people get an idea that this one thing is what I want to be, but they have an idea of what that one thing is, which isn't accurate, right? Mm. Like people go and they go to school. They're like, I want to be a lawyer. And then they go to school. They do 3.5 years and like, this sucks. I don't want to be a lawyer. Right? Like that's not the thing they want to do, but they've put all their effort into it. Right. But maybe what's behind that, right? For example, some people are like, well, I want to be an artist, but really they don't want to tour. They don't want to, they really want to be a songwriter. Right. Mm. But they're committed to this artist thing. But the reality is they want to be a songwriter. So not being so attached to an idea of how, basically being attached to what you want to get out of it. Like I want to be in the music industry in the capacity of dealing with songs. Right. But like how you get there, that may change over time. Right. Like I could go deaf. Right. That would suck as a mixer to be deaf. Right. But then I have to say, okay, well, how can I be of service in my current condition, being that this is no longer a possibility? Right. So then the second part of that is I think people should be promiscuous with the industry, right? Like figuring out, trying out different things and not being so attached to one, because you might find, like for me, I was originally in this school to be a player, like a jazz guitarist. And then I switched to bass but I just didn't have the focus that the other kids had, right, to shed all day. And they were excellent, and I was sucky. But I have a very analytical and logical mind as well. And when I found the studio at the school, and this is in high school, like it sparked. I was like, oh, I get to work on the music, and I get to do that analytical thing of understanding, okay, well, this circuit and that. And it was a lot more involved back then. Now it's just click, click, click on the mouse. But this is where I found my real passion in studio rather than being a jazz musician. I found my passion in the studio, and I didn't get tired of shedding in the studio all the time.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. So I wanted to be in music. I had that single-minded focus, but then being in the studio is what happened along the way.
So I want to try to extrapolate from that a little bit.
Yeah.
In layman's terms, for those that have a hard time committing or focusing on one thing, what you're saying and recommending is it's important to know what you want to do, but also be flexible enough. Like when you say commit, it may not mean commit completely to a very specific point, but you're saying commit to a direction and kind of allow yourself the flexibility to do those tiny moves on your way to Hawaii.
Right.
The tiny micro changes. And I think that that's really important. I feel like people, young people especially, have a really hard time committing because they're so afraid that of a specific direction that they have to take. But you're right. It's about the general direction. It's you got to have that flexibility. It's not as scary if you understand the flexibility.
That said, there are some people who are like, no. I am going to be, the next Jeff Buckley, or I'm going to be the next Mariah Carey, or I'm going to be the next Rihanna, whatever, right? Like they're focused. They're like, this is what I'm doing. This is all I want to do. And actually for those people who are single-minded and who are like developing their craft, then they just have to work their asses off, right? Like to get to that point, because the people who achieve that type of thing, they are, that single, super single laser focus really helps a lot, because there's a lot of rejection.
Oh, that is such a blessing to be able to have that. Like that is so rare, first off, to like be able to commit like that. Oh man. I feel like there's been moments in my life where I've been able to commit to something like that. I feel like when I initially transferred from recording to mixing, like there was a deep level of hyper focus that took me a long way. It's interesting. I want to kind of slowly close the meeting here, but the concept of this is this. I talk about this often because I never thought this would be an issue. But when I moved to LA, I kind of started hitting milestones way too fast. And I was genuine. I like went depressed. I got really depressed. Like everything came a little bit too quickly. And I found out when I got there, I found out it's not exactly what I want. And it didn't exactly solve the problems that I thought it would solve. But it gave me problems that I didn't expect to give me. Like working with celebrities or being in rooms with big people or whatever, the pressure of doing that. And dude, it kind of made me question everything for a while. Like, oh my gosh, I like do, is it music that I want to do or some sort of other creative thing? And for you, I think the last question that I want to ask is, how do you actively stay present and grateful?
How do I actively stay present and grateful? Well, I the present is a hard thing because my mind is always scattered, right? Like, so I'm constantly thinking about things that have happened, things that are going to happen. Of course, what is happening right now, right? So that one is always a hard one for me. I'm trying, my wife is into mindfulness and meditation. She's in that space. Mm-hmm. So like I'm working on absorbing some of that mojo. So that I can be more mindful. And I think in terms of being present, I'm just, I'm recognizing moments as they're happening. And I am essentially throwing up a prayer, you know, at that moment, if I am feeling like I'm being blessed, something good is happening, or if I need assistance or whatever, like I'm kind of marking those moments so that I recognize those moments as they're happening. As far as being grateful, one of the cool things that we do in our family, every night, the whole family, we get together and we do what's called blessings and prayers. And, the blessings part, we get together and everyone in the family goes through their day and lists all the things that they were really happy about or were blessings for them. You know, it could be as simple as like, oh, I got to play with my friend, or, oh, you know, mommy or daddy made an amazing meal. It's always mommy. You know, whatever. Right. But there, we actively try to bring ourselves to account and recognize the things that we're grateful for. And I think that has served us well, as a family, to keep us focused on, because there's always stuff that's really hard about life, but remembering those things that are a blessing, and we literally do it every single day. So I think that's been helpful.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Dude, this has been so amazing talking to you. I kind of, you never know how these conversations are going to go. And we talked a lot more about audio than we usually do. And I feel like it was a very mindful episode. So I appreciate you taking the time to, you know, talk with me, hang out.
Oh man, it was a real pleasure.
It's always a pleasure, man.
I'm always enjoy chatting with you. I love the fact that we never know where the conversation is going to go, but it's always going to go somewhere cool.
Yeah. I always feel like I learned something from you. Definitely. Like some sort of outside perspective inside, which is really great. And dude, we never even talked about it, but I want to say live on the air that I think it's so cool that you have a lot of Japanese credits, man. We didn't even talk about your credits. I mean, the introduction I brought in, I talked about a few of the artists, but dude, Japanese music, man. That's so cool. As a Japanese man, it's like... I think that's so dope.
It's, and I've never even been to Japan.
Someday?
Yeah. Oh, I'd love to. So it's on my list. It's on my list to go.
If the label needs to hire a translator, you know, I got you, my guy.
Oh, sweet. Good to know.
For sure. Anyway, thank you so much, John. I appreciate your time, and good luck to you in Ohio. Good luck with the rest of the studio build. Congrats with all your success recently, man. And for thank many so more much, years brother. To come.
I appreciate it. I look forward to chatting with you again, seeing you in LA, maybe at NAMM.
Oh, heck yeah. You're going to be there?
I hope so.
Yes, I'll be there as well. So, all right, sounds great. Thank you so much. And appreciate right, anybody that stopped by and checked out the pod.
All right, take care, guys.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.